The following program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.
This is Charles Ruas welcoming you to a program from my audio archives from the 1970s. As Director of Arts Programming at WBAI-FM, the Pacifica radio station in New York City, I produced programs that covered all the contemporary arts, including drama, literature, and experimental radio programs as well.
With the cooperation of Clock Tower, these programs have been restored for broadcast on Clock Tower Radio, operating at clocktower.org. In this edition, you will hear a radio show aired in 1974, featuring Mabu Mines performing Beckett. In addition, a greater discussion with five members of Mabu Mines and Rick Harris.
Good evening. Tonight, WBAI Theater is pleased to present a double bill of theater pieces by Samuel Beckett as produced by Mabu Mines. We will first hear The Lost Ones, then an interview between Rick Harris and five members of the Mabu Mines Company, and our evening will conclude with the Mabu Mines production of Samuel Beckett's Cascando. First, we will hear the Mabu Mines production of The Lost Ones, adapted from a story by Samuel Beckett, conceived and directed by Lee Brewer, with music by Philip Glass and performed by David Warrilow.
Abode, where lost bodies roam, each searching for its lost one. Vast enough for search to be in vain, narrow enough for flight to be in vain. Inside a flattened cylinder, 50 meters round and 18 high, for the sake of harmony, the light. Its dimness. Its yellowness. Its omnipresence, as though every separate square centimeter were a gleam of the sum 80,000 of total surface. Its restlessness, at long intervals, suddenly stilled, like panting at the last. Then all go dead still. It is perhaps the end of their abode. A few seconds, and all begins again. Consequences of this light for the searching eye. Consequences for the eye, which, having ceased to search, is fastened to the ground or raised to the distant ceiling where none can be. The temperature. It oscillates with more measured beat between hot and cold. It passes from one extreme to the other in about 4 seconds. It, too, has its moments of stillness, more or less hot or cold. They coincide with those of the light. Then all go dead still. It is perhaps the end of all. A few seconds and all begins again. Consequences of this climate for the skin. It shrivels. The bodies brush together with a rustle of dry leaves. The mucous membrane itself is affected. A kiss makes an indescribable sound. Those with stomachs still to copulate strive in vain, but they will not give in. Floor and wall are of solid rubber or such like. Dash against them foot or fist or head, and the sound is scarcely heard. Imagine, then, the silence of the steps. The only sounds worthy of the name result from the thud of bodies striking against one another, or of one against itself, as when, in sudden fury, it beats its breast. Thus, flesh and bone subsist. The ladders. These are the only objects. They are single without exception and vary greatly in size. The shortest measure no less than 6 meters. Some are fitted with a sliding extension. They are propped against the wall without regard to harmony. Bolt upright on the top rung of the tallest climbers can touch the ceiling with their fingertips. Its composition is no less familiar, therefore, than that of floor and wall. Dash a rung against it, and the sound is scarcely heard. These ladders are in great demand. At the foot of each, at all times or nearly, a little queue of climbers. And yet, it takes courage to climb, for half the rungs are missing, and this without regard to harmony. For if only every second one were missing, no great harm would be done, but the want of 3 in a row calls for acrobatics. These ladders are, nevertheless, in great demand and in no danger of being reduced to mere uprights, wronged at their extremities alone. For the need to climb is too widespread. To feel it no longer is a rare deliverance. The missing rungs are in the hands of a happy few who use them mainly for attack and self-defense. Their solitary efforts to brain themselves culminate at the best in brief losses of consciousness. The purpose of the ladders is to convey the searchers to the niches. Those whom these entice no longer climb simply to get clear of the ground. It is the custom not to climb two or more at a time. To the fugitive fortunate enough to find a ladder free, it offers certain refuge until the clamors subside. The niches, or alcoves. These are cavities sunk in that part of the wall which lies above an imaginary line running midway between floor and ceiling, and features therefore of its upper half alone. A more or less wide mouth gives rapid access to a chamber of varying capacity, but always sufficient for a body in reasonable command of its joints to enter in, and similarly, once in, to crouch down after a fashion. They are disposed in irregular quincunxes, roughly 10 meters in diameter and cunningly out of line. Such harmony only he can relish whose long experience and detailed knowledge of the niches are such as to permit a perfect mental image of the entire system. But it is doubtful that such a one exists, for each climber shows a fondness for certain niches and refrains as far as possible from the others. A certain number are connected by tunnels, opened in the thickness of the wall and attaining, in some cases, no fewer than 50 meters in length. But most have no other way out than the way in. It is as though at a certain stage discouragement had prevailed. To be noted in support of this wild surmise, the existence of a long tunnel abandoned blind. Woe the body that rashly enters here, to be compelled, finally, after long efforts, to crawl back backwards as best it can the way it came. Not that this drama is peculiar to the unfinished tunnel. One has only to consider what must inevitably ensue when two bodies enter a normal tunnel at the same time by opposite ends. Niches and tunnels are subject to the same light and climate as the rest of the abode. So much for a first aperçu of the abode, and of these bodies seen from a certain angle, and of this notion and its consequences, if it is maintained. From time immemorial, rumor has it, or better still, the notion is abroad, that there exists a way out. Those who no longer believe so are not immune from believing so again, in accordance with the notion requiring, as long as it holds, that here all should die, but with so gradual, and to put it plainly, so fluctuant a death as to escape the notice even of a visitor. Regarding the nature of this way out and its location, two opinions divide without opposing, although still loyal to that old belief. One school swears by a secret passage branching from one of the tunnels and leading, in the words of the poet, to nature's sanctuaries. The other dreams of a trap door hidden in the hub of the ceiling, giving access to a flue, at the end of which the sun and other stars would still be shining. Conversion is frequent either way. and such a one who at a given moment would hear of nothing but the tunnel, may well a moment later hear of nothing but the trap door, and a moment later still give himself the lie again. The fact remains, nonetheless, that of these two persuasions, the former is declining in favour of the latter, but in a manner so desultory and slow, and of course with so little effect on the comportment of either sect, that to perceive it one must be in the secret of the gods. This shift has logic on its side. For those who believe in a way out possible of access as via a tunnel, it would be, and even without any thought of putting it to account may be tempted by its quest, whereas the partisans of the trap door are spared this demon by the fact that the hub of the ceiling is out of reach. Thus, by insensible degrees, the way out transfers from the tunnel to the ceiling prior to never having been. So much for a first aperçu of this credence, so singular in itself, and by reason of the loyalty it inspires in the hearts of so many possessed. Its fatuous little light will assuredly be the last to leave them, always assuming they are darkward bound. Floor and ceiling bear no sign or mark apt to serve as a guide. The climber, making off with his ladder to plant it elsewhere, relies largely on feel. There does, nonetheless, exist a north, in the guise of one of the vanquished, or better, one of the women vanquished, or better still, the woman vanquished. She squats against the wall with her head between her knees and her legs in her arms. The hair, tarnished by the light, hides the face and whole front of the body down to the crotch. She is the North. She, rather than some other among the vanquished, because of her greater fixity. To one bent for once on taking his bearings, she may be of help. For the climber, averse to avoidable acrobatics, a given niche may lie so many paces or meters to east or west of the woman vanquished, without, of course, his naming her thus, or otherwise, even in his thought. It is, of course, forbidden to withhold the face or other part from the searcher who demands it, and may, without fear of resistance, remove the hand from the flesh it hides, or raise the lid to examine the eye. The hair of the woman vanquished has thus many a time been gathered up and drawn back, and the head raised, and the face laid bare, and whole front of the body down to the crotch. The inspection once completed, it is usual to put everything carefully back in place as far as possible. So on, infinitely, until, towards the unthinkable end, if this notion is maintained, a last body of all, by feeble fits and starts, is searching still. There he stirs, this last of all, if a man, and some time later opens his burned eyes, and threads his way to that first among the vanquished, so often taken for a guide. On his knees, he parts the heavy hair and raises the unresisting head. Once devoured, the face thus laid bare, the eyes at a touch of the thumbs open without demur. In those calm wastes he lets his wander till they are the first to close, and the head, relinquished, falls back into its place. He himself, after a pause impossible to time, finds at last his place and pose. Whereupon dark descends, and at the same instant the temperature comes to rest, not far from freezing point. Hushed in the same breath, the faint stridulence mentioned above, whence suddenly such silence as to drown all the faint breathings put together. So much, roughly speaking, for the last state of the cylinder, and of this little people of searchers, one first of whom, if a man, in some unthinkable past, for the first time bowed his head, if this notion is maintained.
We have just heard the Mabu Mines production of Samuel Beckett's The Lost Ones, conceived and directed by Lee Brewer, with music by Philip Glass, and performed by David Warrilow. By way of entr'acte, WBAI's Rick Harris speaks with five members of Mabu Mines. I'm Rick Harris, and I'm talking with five members of the Mabu Mines Company, and they are...
Ellen McElduff.
David Warrilow.
Joanne Acolytis.
Bill Raymond.
And Frederick Newman.
Joanne, could you tell me how the name Mabu Mines came into being?
Mabu Mines was organized in 1970, and the first summer we were together, we went to Nova Scotia to rehearse, and we rehearsed near a place called Mabu Mines, which is a deserted mine, and then we decided to name the company Mabu Mines rather than some kind of theater name, like the Such and Such Experimental Theater.
Mabu Mines doesn't work out of one particular space. Is that deliberate?
Well, we'd like to have a space. That's financial. I think it would be wonderful for us to have a theater, just in terms of having everything in the same place. And we've moved around so much in the past 5 years. And we've performed in a lot of different places, too, rehearsed in different places. That's been nice. I feel that we've been lucky, because every new place that we perform, we meet new people, new theater people, and also develop a new audience.
But on the other hand, it's a little like being on tour all the time perennially for, you know, 5-6 years.
You spoke earlier of the way in which this company works. Could you try to describe the way Mabu Mines Company works as you see it?
One basic difference between the way this company works and the way so much other theater is done is that instead of getting together a group of actors under a director and then having a process whereby the director asks for certain things, the actors just compete to give, the best that they know how to for themselves and damn everybody else. The process that seems to go on, that one encourages anyway in this company, is one of mutual development. In other words, you might know something about a person that they will not perceive or think of using at a particular moment. And if you point it out to them and then show them how it can be used, very often you can get something very rich and original from a person, and not in a spirit of competition at all, but only in the terms of the interest for the making of the piece. And so sometimes it does happen, of course, that people can come in with a bit which they want to show or do, but usually that's not something that works out and it usually gets ditched, or it's turned into something really usable and something that can grow during the process of rehearsal and performance. Because a lot of the company's work grows in performance, even though we have a long rehearsal period, because it's such a different experience. But once the piece is solidly there and ready to be performed, then it seems to grow within itself. And then we drop pieces for a while and come back to them and find that we come back with a new perception of them and a new kind of input of energy.
You know, there's another aspect of the collaboration too, and that is that there's a lot of discussion that goes on about the conception of a piece and whether a concept will work in a piece or whether it won't work, or the aesthetic of a piece, you know, and whether that's going to work. And the actors have a lot to say about that too, although ultimately, most often, they will at least give a wholehearted try to the concept that a director may be using. And by that I mean maybe work on it for 2 months or something like that, you know. But it's all there is always that questioning, that kind of questioning that exists.
It might be interesting to ask Ellen, actually, what her perception is of the way the company works, since this is her first piece that she's been in with the company. What strikes you about this company that you didn't come across before in theatre, or that you don't see in other companies that you've seen working in New York, for example?
Well, actually, I know very little about the way other companies in New York work.
Mm-hmm.
I know most about Mabu Mines because my first connection with any kind of avant-garde theatre was Mabu Mines when Lee Brewer came to my college in Memphis, Tennessee, when I was a senior, to teach a workshop. And he taught us some of the methods that the company used that they had, I don't know, I guess you found them other places. I know from the Open Theater.
Yeah, we just ripped them off from everywhere else.
Yeah. Well, a lot from Lutovsky.
Oh, yeah.
A lot are developed in rehearsal, though, a lot of these techniques.
What kinds of techniques are we talking about here? For instance, Joe Chaykin uses certain kinds of exercises. One identifies, for instance, Richard Chechner with an environmental approach to theater. Would one identify with Mabu Mines as their relatively particular approach?
Total eclecticism.
It's very eclectic on all levels, even on the level of decisions about what kind of things we want to learn. And often the decision is pragmatic. We decided that we had to learn Tai Chi, and we made up a reason for it to use in a piece. Then we decided we wanted to deal with body isolations, so we studied belly dancing for the Bee Beaver animation. And we learn these things, we use whatever we can, and then we drop them. And
we also use acting, don't we?
Sure, sure. I think our acting technique is basically based on Grotowski's technique, which is using images from your personal history, from your own life, and the text as an occasion to work the images out through your voice and through your body.
And the total
it's different
extension.
From Stanislavski in that there's no... I'm sorry. There's no use of emotional memory. There's no identification with the character. The actor is the reality. And I think that Mabu Mines is an interesting theater in that it's totally actor-oriented. So the excellence of the theater is due to the excellence of the actors.
Well, not entirely, as has been shown in Cascando. Cascando is a very big extension of the whole idea of image work, personal image work, in the sense that when Joanne came to do the piece, again, she used the text, I think this is correct, as a reason to stage some ideas and images of her own, which were elicited by the text. And it's not that the text is unimportant, as some people seem to have thought, having seen the production. It is that it's a very good vehicle for communicating certain images and perceptions. And that seems to me the most interesting thing that Cascando has achieved, is that it has taken into the directorial area a total extension of the idea that the text is used by the actors as a vehicle for putting over certain images.
Could you also describe the physical environment in which Cascando takes place for our audience?
It's meant to be a room in a house, and filled with junk, filled with objects. It's very dense, it's very crowded. The opener, played by Fred Newman, sits in a rocking chair downstage, and he has his own paraphernalia, a radio, shaving equipment, books that he's very beautifully arranged with wrenches and screwdrivers to keep the place. And the voice is played by David Warlow, Ellen, Bill, and David Hardy. They're sitting around a table.
And Tom Cathcart.
And they're sitting around a table, and they each have a lot of paraphernalia that they're involved in. David knits. Ellen does coloring in a coloring book, makes toilet paper flowers. Bill does soap carving. Tom is involved in working on this. I still don't even know what it is. Some critics said it looked like a homemade bomb. David Hardy is building a model ship. There's a goldfish on the set. There's a lot of old radios.
We mustn't forget the cellist.
And Arthur is in the corner, Arthur Russell, who plays the cello. He has his own paraphernalia. He has comic books. He eats cabbage. He plays games. There are a lot of pictures on the walls. There are maps. And the audience is led in through a passageway, a narrow passageway, to a back room in Richard Foreman's theater. It's a perfect room to do the piece. And I had an idea that I wanted to do it in a hotel room. The people would open a door and they would see this scene, this total environment. But of course, you know, that only two or three people could see the piece. Or in a basement, something like that.
That was an interview between Rick Harris and Joanne Acolytis, David Warlow, Frederick Newman, Ellen McElduff, and William Raymond of Mabu Minds. We will now hear the Mabu Minds production of Samuel Beckett's radio play, Cascando, staged by Joanne Acolytis, with music by Philip Glass, performed by Arthur Russell. The opener is Frederick Newman. The voice is Ellen McElduff, David Warlow, William Raymond, Tom Cathcart, and David Hardy.
It's the month of May! For me! Yes! That's right! I open!
Story! If you could finish it, you could rest, you could sleep. Not before. Oh, I know the ones I finished.
Thousands and
one. All I ever did in my life with my life, saying to myself, finish this one, it's the right one, and rest and sleep. No more stories.
No more words.
And finished it, not the right one. Couldn't rest straight away. Another to begin to finish, saying to myself, finish this one, then rest this time. It's the right one. This time you have it, and finished it, not the right one. Couldn't rest straight away. Another. But this one, it's different. I'll finish it, then rest. It's the right one. This time I have it. I've got it. Woolburn. I resume a long life already. Say what you like. A few misfortunes. That's enough. 5 years later, 10 years. I don't know. Woolburn.
He's changed.
Not enough.
Recognizable in the shed, yet another, waiting for night to fall, to go out, go on, elsewhere, sleep elsewhere, it's slow. He lifts his head now and then, his eyes to the window, it's darkening, the earth is darkening, it's night. He gets up, knees first, then up, and his feet slips out.
Woburn!
Same old coat, right the sea, left the hills, he has the choice, he has only...
And I closed! I opened the other.
Mm-hmm.
my clothes. I opened both.
On? It's getting on.
Finish it.
Don't give up. Then rest. Sleep.
Not before finish it.
It's the right one.
This time you have it.
You've got it. It's there.
Somewhere.
You've got him.
Don't lose him. Follow him, woman story.
Getting on.
Finish it, then sleep.
No more stories. No more words.
Come on.
Next thing...
And I close. I start again.
Down. Gentle slope. Boring. Giant aspens. Wind in the boughs. Faint sea.
Woburn.
Same old coat, he goes then. Stops, not a soul. Not yet. Night too bright. Say what you like, the bank. He hugs the bank. Same old stick. He goes down, falls. On purpose or not, can't see, he's down. That's what counts. Face in the mad arms spread. That's the idea.
Already.
We're there. Already.
No, not yet. He gets up, knees first, hands flat in mud, head sunk.
Then up, on his feet.
Huge bulk. Come on. He goes on. He goes down. Come on.
His head. What's in his head?
A hole. A shelter. A hollow in the dunes. A cave. Vague memory.
His head.
Of a cave. He goes down. No more trees. No more bank.
He's changed.
Not enough.
Night too bright. Soon the dunes. No more cover. He stops. Not a soul. Not... Oh.
Thank you.
It's in his head. It's not. I open.
False. False.
False.
Again.
Again, on purpose or not. Can't see. He's down. That's what matters.
Face in the sand,
arms spread, bare dunes. Not a scrub.
Same
old coat. Night too bright, say what you like. See louder, like thunder, manes a foam. Whoa, burn his head. What's in his head? Peace again in his head. No, further to go, to seek sleep. No, not yet. He gets up,
knees
first, hands flat in the sand. Head sunk, then up on his feet. Huge bulk, same old broad brim, jammed down.
Come on.
He's off again, ton. Weight in the sand,
knee
deep, he goes down.
See, I close. I open the other. He opens nothing. He has nothing to open. It's in his head. Well, they don't see me. They don't see what I do. They don't see what I have. And they say he opens nothing. He has nothing to open. It's in his head. Oh, I don't protest anymore. I don't say anymore. Well, there's nothing in my head. I don't answer anymore. I open and close.
Lights of the land,
the
island, the sky. He need only lift his head, his eyes. He'd see them shine on him. But now he.
Live on that. Well, they don't see me. They don't see what I live on. And they say that is not his life. And he does not live on that. I've lived on it pretty long. Long enough! Listen! That's not all. Now I open both. Listen.
Sleep. No more searching. To find him in the dark. To see him. To say him. For whom? That's it. No matter. Never him.
Never right. Start again. In the dark. Done with that. This time it's right. We're there. Nearly. Finish.
From one world to another. As though they drew together. We have not much further to go. Come on, good.
Nearly.
Nearly.
I've got him.
I've got him.
I've seen him. I've said him.
We're there, nearly.
No more stories. I'll fall.
This time is the right one. I have it.
Finish it.
Sleep, Woburn.
It's him. I've got him. Follow him, too.
Good. Yes, that's right. The month of May. You know, the reawakening. I open.
No chiller, no thwarts, no oars, the float sucked out.
Then back, aground, drags free, out.
Woburn.
He fills it flat out, facing the bilge, arms spread.
Same old coat.
Hands clutching the gunwales.
No, I don't know.
I see him.
He clings on.
Out to sea.
Heading nowhere.
For the island.
Then, no more.
Else.
Scudding, rearing, plunging.
Heading nowhere.
Heading nowhere.
For the island.
For the island.
Then no more.
Then no more.
Elsewhere.
Elsewhere.
Anywhere. Anywhere. Heading anywhere.
Heading anywhere.
Lights.
Lights.
No resemblance! And that! Is that mine too? But I don't answer anymore. And they don't say anything anymore. They have quit. Yes, that's right. The month of May. The end of May. The long days. I open. I'm afraid to open. But I must open. So I open.
Come on. Open, arms spread. Same old coat, face in the bilge, he clings on. Island astern, far astern. Heading out, fast deep, no more land. His head. What's in his head?
Come on, come on!
At last, no more coming, no more going, seeking elsewhere, always elsewhere. We're there, nearly. Woburn, hang on, don't let go. Light's gone of the land, all gone, nearly all. Too far, too late. Of the sky, those, if you like, he need only turn over. He'd see them shine on him. But no, he clings on.
He's changed.
Nearly enough.
Good God! Good God! Good God! There was a time I asked myself, what is it? There were times I answered, well, it's the outing. Two outings, then the return. Where? went to the village, to the inn. Two outings, and at last the return to the village, to the inn, by the only road that leads there, an image like any other, but I don't answer any more. I open.
Don't let go. Finish. It's the right one. I have it. This time, we're there.
Auburn, nearly.
And so they had joined arms.
No more stories. Come on.
Auburn, it's him. See him. Say him.
To the end. Don't let go.
God.
Nearly. Just a few more. A few more. I'm there. Nearly.
God.
It was him.
I've got him.
Nearly.
This time, it's right. Nearly. No more stories. Sleep.
We're there. Nearly. Just a few more. Don't let go.
Auburn.
He clings on. Come on. Come on.
We've been listening to a double bill of Samuel Beckett's Cascando and The Lost Ones, as produced by Mabu Minds. This broadcast has been made possible by the permission of Samuel Beckett and his publisher, Grove Press. It was produced for radio by Rick Harris, with technical production by Peter Zanger, technical assistance for Mabu Minds by Terence O'Reilly, and interview recorded by Jessica Goodyear. Thank you for listening.
This is Charles Ruas. You've been listening to a selection from my historic archives.
With the cooperation of Clock Tower, these programs have been restored for broadcast on Clock Tower Radio, operating at clocktower.org.
The previous program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.